It's Wednesday, July 29th, 2009, and you're listening to episode 158 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 3 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Chad.
My name is John.
My name is Pat.
My name is Chris.
Power 16-2 finale. This is the last week we are going to let it run. Julie Hussey versus Baron Von Badass. This is your last chance to decide the fate of the universe. It's also your last chance to get your email address entered for the drawing for the Catalyst Prizes.
That's right.
And we're in Battletech's 25th year anniversary, Chris tells me.
That's right. It's 25 years of Battletech. And they actually are putting out a very sweet product coming down the road here. It's 25 years of art and fiction, where basically they have a bunch of new stories by old and new Battletech authors. And they've got some of the sweetest artwork that Battletech has ever had over the course of its history and stories to go along with it.
Do they also have another book called The Worst Art of Battletech History? Because they've had some pretty big stinkers, too.
You know, there's bad art in all games. But yes, Battletech certainly has had its fair share, without a doubt.
The standard of art really has risen. I mean, There's very few means by which you can objectively measure one system against the next. But those books, even from like the mid-90s and before, God help you, were so bad.
Well, I think that if you weren't one of the big two or big three, even the big three suffered from it. It was basically such a low-rent business that your buddy Ted owed you a favor. You paid him in a case of beer, and he just
scrawled
something
down. Well, it was a cottage industry.
Down.
I mean, two dudes made up a role-playing system and did all of it.
Mm-hmm.
So
I'm just so happy that Battletech has the rights to the 14 unseen mechs back. So
yes.
The original Locust.
Well, no. My understanding, and I could be wrong, is that Catalyst Games does not have the original Japanese mechs from the three different animes. But the people who do the video game who were...
Oh, the video game got it back.
The video game got it back.
Not Catalyst.
And the names are slipping my mind. But basically, the original Battletech guy, a couple of the original people who did Battletech...
Right.
Started a video game company that bought the rights from Microsoft back to do Battletech video games. Then they cut deals with the owners of the IPs of the Japanese animes.
Yeah, I was going to say, that has to be what happened, because the original guys never had a claim to the IP in the first place. They stole it.
Yeah.
There's no way you can just get it back after an amount of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're paying licensing fees and stuff.
Well, they should have done it the first time and saved themselves a whole lot of headache.
Yeah. Well, it was a cottage industry. And, you know,
no one goes to Japan or watches Japanese cartoons.
Yeah, exactly. If you have no idea what we're talking about, you should Google Battletech Unseen Mechs.
Basically,
there's a Wikipedia article on it. It's pretty interesting.
Back in the day, the guys who put Battletech together just stole hand over fist a couple mech designs from a few different Japanese animes. And then they got sued for it, big time.
Which I never understood, because the ones that they designed themselves actually looked just fine.
Yeah, no, they could do it. I mean, this is something that probably literally saved them like 4 hours of work.
Yeah.
And destroyed their company.
Exactly. I have no idea.
Well, how they started. I don't think that they were making games first. They were making model kits. And they made model kits.
I thought model kits was a separate company.
I think it was the first company.
Oh.
And that's how they kind of made their initial money. And then they got sued on that. Like I said, there's a whole article on Wikipedia that really explains the whole thing.
Well, anyway. Risk versus reward, man. Don't cut a corner that can kill you.
And going from 1989 to 2009, you got about a week and a half left to get signed up for the Gen Con stuff. So be sure to get out to the site. Go to feartheboot.com/GenCon or click the link in the show notes, or go to feartheboot.com and click the Gen Con link. However you do it, just do it. Get signed up for the guerrilla events. We've got a lot of great stuff in mind. Had a ton of fun last year, even though we weren't quite as organized with this. So this year we're putting a system to it, and I can't wait. It's going to be a blast. Don't miss out on this. Get signed up for it. Chad, you've got a shout out to give to somebody.
Yes, I would like to give a incredibly belated shout out to Kellum Sowers in Florida.
Put my name on this as well.
Yeah, he is a cigar smoker on our forums, but the dude for Father's Day mails me some cigars. He is my home address, and he mails me some cigars, and it was just a really nice thing to do. Well, not only did he do that, he wrote a handwritten letter telling us just how much he appreciates what we're doing, how great he thinks we are, telling me about the cigars and that sort of thing. And it was just, I don't think I've ever received a handwritten letter in my whole life.
He sent some to me with a handwritten letter as well. He's an incredibly nice guy.
He is. Great guy. Thanks a lot, Kellum. We appreciate it very much.
St. Carmelita has some things coming your way, Kellum.
And I do have to apologize that this letter is dated June 29th. And
it will go live on July 29th. So it's about a month late.
Yeah, because I got it in and it sat on my shelf for a couple days. And then we recorded. And then it's like, oh, I need to bring this in and show these to the guys. And then I'm running out the door and I forget it. And we record. And that happens twice. And then I finally get the letter and the cigars and stuff over to the guys. And the letter sitting here, we're talking, oh, yeah, that's cool. We got to thank him for this. That's really awesome. And then we totally forget.
Well, the problem is we didn't put the shout out in the script rewrite before every episode that we just read off of.
Right.
Like
that's
right now.
Very true.
Chris, you sent me a link to something that I want to mention on the show. And it's a movie trailer for a movie that is being produced by Fantasy Flight Games for the Midnight RPG.
Yes.
I want to start with a huge caveat that, as we talked about on a prior show, trailers can be massively deceiving. But from the trailer, this looks really good.
It does look good.
It looks pretty badass. And I think what came to mind as I was watching this...
Wait a minute. What the hell is it?
It's a movie. It looks to me like it's a full-length movie, and it's based upon their Midnight RPG. And I'm not 100% sure, but I know when it originally came out, I believe it was D20 based. It may have changed since then. But for the movie, it doesn't matter because they're not rolling dice.
So this is somebody's tabletop game.
It essentially is a chronicle of stuff going on in this world. And it's basically, I think the way this game was explained to me when it first came out was, it's what would it be like if Sauron won? And the world was indeed covered in darkness, and now you had to play the role of people who were fighting against this darkness. And that's probably a very broad generalization, but then again, I don't care. So, but yeah, the movie trailer, it looks pretty good. And for whatever budget they have for this, it looks like they're making the most of it.
Yeah,
is it a movie trailer that's just advertising the game and they have no intention of making a movie?
It's for a movie. It's for a full-length movie. There's a link there where you can click to pre-order the DVD and all that stuff. It's not a trailer for the game. It's a trailer for a movie. And I was shocked as hell because it's an RPG movie. And once again, trailers can be deceiving, but the trailer looked really good. And it would be nice for this hobby to finally have a movie. Yeah,
well,
exactly.
To finally have a movie
that's not a horrific embarrassment.
But Dan, I'm holding Dragonlance in my hand.
Yeah, and I've seen Dungeons & Dragons with Jeremy Irons at least 7 times.
We have that movie, boys and girls. It's the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
That's true.
Live it, learn it, love it.
Yeah, but there wasn't a game, though, before the movie came out.
Yeah, there didn't need to be, dude.
The games were all retarded stepchildren
of the Lord of the Rings.
Yep.
Yeah.
No offense to retards or stepchildren. Cut that out.
No.
You know, Dan, the point that you're making, it's nice to see, though, obviously with new media options that are out there, because, you know, there's all kinds of low-budget projects going on out there that people are either putting on YouTube or they have their own webpage for, and it's just, you know, short serials and stuff. And so this is kind of a natural extension of that, where this company who makes, you know, mind-bogglingly expensive board games, but good at the same time, is using some of the tremendous truckloads of cash they make to, you know, try and help expand their appeal.
You know, you make me feel really bad for owning all the Arkham Horror expansions. I played that over the weekend, by the way. We totally lost.
I've never played that game.
I am probably going to bring it down to Fear the Con.
Fear the Con Indy.
Yeah, I'm probably going to bring this down to Gen Con and play some games of it, because the board game lending library, because it's such a popular game, it's always checked out, and it's really hard to get a game up. So I expect to see a guerrilla game of Arkham Horror. I have all but the most recent expansion, which came out this month, I think, and we played over the weekend, and we used every rule, every expansion, every card, everything for the first time. And we didn't use any house rules, and we played the straight up game. It was hard, and we got our asses kicked.
It's fun, though.
It was a fun loss.
6 days of the gamer cruise, I played 2/3 of one game. and it was Arkham Horror. Mm-hmm. And I have no regrets.
It was very, very good.
You know, the Midnight movie game or game/movie is not the only one that's like that. For those of you who remember the game, Pinnacle put out Brave New World back a number of years ago, and Matt Forbick was behind it.
Is that the superhero one?
Yes, and that is also being made into a movie as well. I'm talking to Mr. Forbeck. We're going to try and get an interview with him when we go down there for Gen Con. But that is, there's also going to be, they're going to reveal some stuff for that at Gen Con as well. So that too is another game essentially being turned into a movie, which again, is kind of cool.
As long as it doesn't suck.
Yes.
Quick aside, since we did mention Fear the Con, as soon as Gen Con has passed, we will have some more details on Fear the Con. There's actually been some planning going on. I think we've got a weekend picked and all that stuff. So those of you that are looking to come to Fear the Con 3, either to enjoy again what you've seen before or not miss what you keep missing, then stay tuned, because as soon as Gen Con's over and done with, we're going to start working in diligence upon Fear the Con 3, because we've got some new ideas for it this year.
Strippers.
Tons of them.
Yes. Or diligently as well, you know. Whatever.
I say strippers, and now Pat is totally interested in Fear the Con.
I just barely
came to the others. Yes.
Yeah. Hello. I'll be there with bells on.
All right.
Singles.
Speaking of movies, a video game has come out, which I've had some very curmudgeon-y trepidation about.
Yes.
And I'm going to say up
front. What a shock.
It's totally curmudgeon-y, and here's why. For those of you that have been playing video games since they've been around, you will recall back in the early, maybe mid-80s, there was a Ghostbusters video game that came out, which was a kind of an open-ended pseudo-RPG where you built a franchise, where you had guys, you purchased equipment, you went out on jobs, you raised money, you bought more equipment, until eventually the city's psychokinetic level reached such a point where the whole Gozer event occurs.
It's not even one Twinkie.
It was old. It was dated. For years, I had been hoping that they would apply all these newfangled technologies to making an update of that video game. Take Ghostbusters, bring it up the level of XCOM, bring it past the level of XCOM to where we are today, and have a really kick-ass, open-ended franchise-building game.
So basically what you're saying, you want a, not with the hookers and killing people, but the Grand Theft Auto of Ghostbusters.
Something like this, more franchise. Yeah,
sure.
It's not just
and more focus.
Yeah, more focus. And so they have released, it just came out a couple weeks ago, a Ghostbusters video game, which is not that. It is a story-driven, very railroaded first-person shooter. And I've not touched the game.
Yes.
So I have no fair review of it outside of saying it's not what I was hoping for. But beyond that, I have no review of the game whatsoever. But Chad, you own it and are playing it. And
I absolutely freaking love this game. It is awesome. There are so many problems with the game. It's a box canyon. It is one step away from being a rail shooter. And what a rail shooter is, these old games where you don't move your character. You kind of move your character right and left, and it goes down a box canyon, not of your own volition, and you shoot things. Well, the game is so box canyon-y. You can only go in one direction. You can only go one way, and it's down this canyon of buildings or a canyon of hallways and such, and there isn't much variety to the weapons. There's not much variety to the gameplay. The AI, kind of dumb. You know, some things are unnecessarily hard, some are unnecessarily difficult, but none of that matters because the game is so fun. It is awesome. You really feel like you're busting a ghost. It's a third-person shooter, and it's not just a matter of you have a proton pack, and the ghost has hit points, and you blast, 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 and then it's dead. You gotta zap it a little bit, weaken it, and then you grab it. You hold it with the proton pack.
Right, you trap it in the stream. And then
well, and then you're trapping in the stream, and you're kind of like slamming it around and stuff, and then the more people who put their stream on it, control it as well until you kind of got it, and then somebody throws a ghost trap out and you have to maneuver it over to the ghost trap, and it's fighting, and you're really fighting with this thing. You're really trying to get it in there and slamming it around, weaken it, and then you get it and get in there and you can't cross the streams, and boom, and you get it in, and you're like, yes, I totally busted this ghost. And then you stop and you look around. And this room that you're in, which was like a pristine dining room of an old hotel, or it's an old library filled with antique books, or it's the basement with lots of expensive equipment and things like that, is on fire. Tables are cut in half by your proton stream. You look around and there's trails of burn marks that are on fire that you put there trying to chase this ghost down. Stuff is scattered everywhere. The room is totally wrecked. And your score is based on two things. It's money. You have the money you're earning by trapping ghosts to buy new equipment.
Versus the damage you're doing.
Versus the damage you're doing that the city is charging you for.
Liability.
And you get like, I'm playing on Xbox, and when I played the demo, it was so difficult because the AI was dumb as a brick. The AI was killing me. And you have to get the rescue thing where you're injured and the AI guy has to come over and pick you up and you have to do the same thing for them. And so I'm trapping this ghost. I had to reload like 5 times. I was getting real pissed off at it because it was stupid stuff that involved gameplay mechanics that kept killing me. It's frustrating as hell. And then it's like I finally get this ghost trapped. It's just like all this music. And then dead silence and just beep, 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 beep. And you're like, yes, that's awesome. I totally busted the ghost. And then I stop and I look around at this room that I destroyed and I just start laughing out loud because it was so Ghostbusters to
right.
me. It sold it so much.
Well, and I have a lot of emotion tied up in this because for me growing up,
this is your favorite movie.
Yes, Ghostbusters was to me what Star Wars is to every other geek but me. You know, everyone else, you sat around with your friends, you made Star Wars jokes, you had Star Wars toys, you quoted Star Wars, you could recite the whole movie from memory. That was Ghostbusters to me. It wasn't Star Wars. I could even tell you all kinds of backstory stuff about what the proton packs originally looked like. I can even tell you about some of the real occultism that they based this on.
Because Harold Ramis and Dan Aykroyd were really into that.
Yeah, Harold Ramis, Ivan Reitman, and Dan Aykroyd, whoever, a bunch of those guys were really into that. And I can tell you about some of the parapsychology and stuff. But when this game came out, I also had such a fondness for that franchise-building style of game. And it's funny because you talking about getting backcharged for what the damage you do kind of reminds me of the internal economics of XCOM Apocalypse, where if you do too much damage, you can actually mess up different corporations, and they'll eventually send people to kill you and such. But something that intrigued me as a fan of the movies about Ghostbusters, the video game, is for years they have been kicking around a Ghostbusters 3.
Yeah.
And I actually even read an interview probably 5-10 years ago with Dan Aykroyd where he even laid out the plot he had in mind, but they've never got it off the ground. And so some part of me wonders, purely guessing here, if the Ghostbusters video game was the best deal they could get on making a third movie.
Well,
because they got all the actors back.
They roll the credits at the beginning and it says Ghostbusters video game, whatever, written by Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis. They wrote it.
And so I wonder if
I enjoy this game so much because I feel like I am playing a Ghostbusters movie. They have all the music, even the little incidental stuff, like that little chirpy music when they're kind of walking down the hallway. Right. Nothing's really happening. They have that kind of going on. And,
well, they got almost all the actors.
All the actors in it. All the actors who matter are in it. And
did they get Ernie Hudson?
Yes, they did.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. I'm in.
And it's great. You run around with one each of them, sometimes two of them, sometimes all four of them and stuff. And you play a rookie, a guy that they hired to test new equipment. And they don't even ask you your name. They call you new guy and rookie and stuff. They show the character and he's wearing the jumpsuit and his name badge says rookie. My favorite part of it, because they revisit all of the old Ghostbuster stuff from the movies. They don't really cover anything original. They use all their past successes.
Well, and also,
but they do it so well.
Well, and also from what you were telling me, the gameplay is also kind of a bitch.
The gameplay is a bitch, although they did release a patch. The AI is better. It used to be you threw down a ghost trap and they would throw down a ghost trap and then you'd both lock a ghost and then you'd have to fight the AI on do their trap. You want to do your trap and you fight them. Now it doesn't do that. The AI doesn't kill you anymore, you know, with their proton streams and stuff as much. And there's been a lot of improvements just on the AI.
But intrigues me is the fact that it sounds like this game, I mean, really, the gameplay is limited, if not outright broken in some places. But it sounds like the entire game is really carried based on the acting, the humor. Like, you were telling me that if you go into the Ghostbusters firehouse, that they have the painting of Viggo in there. You could actually carry on conversations with Viggo.
You can click it, and the face animates. And he talks stuff. He says really funny thing. Janine is there at the desk, and she's answering the phone and saying all these things that build like the world up around it. Really sells you on it. Like, they go into the ballroom of the Sedgwick Hotel, which is the hotel where they first did their real ghost busting.
They caught Slimer.
They caught Slimer, and you actually are fighting Slimer again because he escaped.
Slimer's so ambiguous. He's good, then he's bad, then he's good again.
Well, he's John Belushi. Or Jim Belushi. Which one? No.
John Belushi?
Jim is the one
still alive.
Jim is the one who...
John Belushi. Yeah. No, he is John Belushi. See, he died, and they were all good friends of him, and that's why he's a fat, obnoxious glutton who likes to drink.
Did he die before the original Ghostbusters?
Yes.
Really? I didn't realize he died that long ago.
Slimer is the ghost of John Belushi.
Yeah, John.
That's their tribute to him. And anyway, so you're fighting him, and you go into this ballroom, and the maitre d' is like, oh, no, we can't. It's the Rodriguez bar mitzvah. They've got to come in and stuff. And then so you go through, and you have to sneak into the ballroom, and then Bill Murray's character is like, did that guy say Rodriguez bar mitzvah?
I was just thinking the same thing.
Well, it's no difference than a Perez bar mitzvah.
I was thinking that.
It's Xbox, so they have achievements. One of the achievements you can get is called kosher. And all the hint says is you have to make the Rodriguez bar mitzvah orthodox. And I'm like,
so
what the hell
is proton pack to, like, destroy the shellfish?
And... No, so they have a buffet lined out. And Slimer's
got to go kill the pigs.
There is a ham on the buffet hidden amongst the stuff, and you have to go and find the ham and blast it with your proton pack. And then when you do that, it blows up, and the buffet's kosher now. And so
except for the fact that there's ham on everything.
On everything, yeah.
Instead of just in one little...
The same knife that hacked up the ham probably hacked up the whole tray. And
well,
whatever.
Just disintegrated it and put it into the air and all over the rest of the food.
It's a fun game with a really good sense of humor, and it totally displays the feel of Ghostbusters. It's amazing because every single movie video game that has ever come out sucks. Doesn't capture the feel of the movie. It's a terrible video game. They're usually boring, and they're just riding on the coattails of the success of the movie. This is not the case. I love it. It is totally not what you want, Dan. It is not.
Yeah.
You're not building the Ghostbusters franchise. You're not running a business. You're not doing your own thing. You're not choosing missions and getting missions and driving around the city in the Ectomobile. All that would have been cool, but that's not this game.
Yeah, and that's the game I still hope someday
they'll make. And I am going to totally lend you this game when I'm done with it. You must play it.
I'm sure I will.
It's great.
But the game I still hope they'll make someday is where you're not in New York, you're a spinoff franchise, Chicago, St. Louis, Kansas City, L.A., I don't care. But the point is that you're a spinoff city, you've got to hire people, you've got to pay their paychecks, you've got to buy the proton packs, you know, your Ectomobile starts off as like this little piece of crap Chevette or something, and you've got to upgrade it, and, you know, really, but the missions are all randomly generated, but in the background of it, they have an overarching story that will build up some kind of climax that finishes the game, and I still hope they'll make that game someday, and I hope the success of this game paves the way for that. And well, I say success, I actually have no idea how well this game is selling, but
I have no idea. People are talking about it. There seems to be a buzz about it. It's getting positive reviews as far as I can tell.
It's all over the place on Steam.
Yeah,
not that that means it sold well, but
I'm playing Last Remnant right now after giving up on Star Ocean, which Last Remnant, I'm not very far into the game, but this is the first game I've played where they take a turn-based strategy RPG and actually make it really slick and quit playing without dumbing it down. I'm really enjoying the combat in it. It's a very neat approach to combat. It's kind of the checkers versus chess sort of thing. It's hard to describe.
Love the JRPGs.
I do love the JRPGs. I'm an addict.
Which is odd, because you really, generally speaking, you don't like anime, but you love JRPGs.
You don't like non-sandboxy games, and very few JRPGs are.
Yeah, and I really dislike at least modern JRPGs.
Right.
I cannot get
into I broke up with JRPGs about Final Fantasy VIII.
The only one
they were a faculty of my childhood.
The only one lately I'd say that was good, worth playing, that you missed out on would be Lost Odyssey, the last half. First half's a little bit crappy, but discs 3 and 4 of Lost Odyssey I thought were fantastic.
What killed that game for me is lack of save points. I got way, way too far in too many missions and died at the end and lost an hour's worth of progress. You do that 2-3 times, and I was done.
There's really no excuse for the existence of save points anymore.
Yep, I agree.
You can save whenever. You have hard drives
now. You can in Last Remnant. You can save anywhere you are.
Well, you should be able to in every game.
I completely agree. I mean, forget hard drives, even going all the way back to when they had the little memory cards.
Yeah.
I'm with you. The existence of save points was ridiculous. You should be able to save anywhere.
Mm-hmm. By now, it's a genre convention like 9999 that's there because it's been there and is ridiculous and stupid.
Yeah. Or 256.
Or that.
Or 255. I'm sorry.
It was 255.
Well, it's the size of a byte. In older video games, they had to really conserve memory because they had so little to work with. So they would typically tag every stat to 1 byte of data. Well, a byte of data can only hold the values of 0 through 255. That's why in so many old video games, if you maxed out a stat, it would stop at 255. Was because that was an even byte. So, stupid little trivia for anyone that played a lot of old video games. Anyways, let's get to role-playing games, tabletop ones. We're picking up a topic that we wandered into unwittingly last episode. We were intending to talk about one thing and realized we were actually talking about a much bigger topic. And so now we're going to take on that bigger topic, which is the concept of balance within a role-playing game. When we talk about balance within a role-playing game, we are talking about the idea that every character is equal to that of the guy next to you. Okay? So if you're playing D&D, for example, and I'm going to try and avoid examples too much here, because for 2 episodes straight now, I've made the mistake of giving examples, and everyone nitpicks the tree instead of the forest.
Wah.
Yeah, I know. If it was you, you'd be bitching
about
it.
Poor Dan.
Send your gift baskets to the box. Anyway, but if it's the idea, let's say you're playing D&D, if you have a 5th-level mage...
You know what? I think that that's the problem, actually.
D&D?
The example is D&D.
Okay.
And so people can haul out 40 years of rule books.
Let's take Rifts.
Oh, God, let's not. Let's go back to D&D.
Oh, let's go to Shadowrun.
Well, Shadowrun has additions, too. Rifts has no additions. That's why I grab Rifts. Does a glitter boy and a mage, both upon entering the game, do they both offer the same amount to what's going on?
Rifts is the perfect example of a game that is inherently unbalanced. I think that in a balancing discussion, though, you have to remember one thing, is that we're not talking about GM intervention. Because a GM has the final authority, and he can say anything is balanced.
Yes. GM also sets the challenges and can destroy balances that way. If your game is a box canyon of locked doors, then the thief is all-powerful, even if he's not.
Yeah.
Well, here's how I was defining balance. Let me pitch a definition that we can use as a common definition for this show. I don't care what you've read on RPGNet. And what I want to know is, can you guys agree to this definition of balance? That balance,
your definitions limit me, I disagree.
Okay. But balance is basically a measure of whether every character at the table, presuming all things equal, okay, they're the same level, same whatever that is in your game, will contribute equally to the entirety of the play experience over the long haul of a general campaign, a generic campaign.
I would agree to that with a caveat. As long as we're talking about equal opportunity rather than equal result, yes.
Okay, and I can agree with that. And the reason I wanted to stress the entirety of play is because the fact is, if you have a party that consists of the diplomat and the guy in powered armor with 2 miniguns, obviously in combat, one guy's all-powerful, and at the negotiating table, the other guy's all-powerful. So when we talk about
I think a lot of NPCs would respond to the power armor and the 2 guns more than the diplomacy check.
Well, maybe.
Sci-fi Al Capone right there.
Yeah.
What I wanted to avoid was
the straight combat comparison.
Or
which is what D&D is now.
Or debating it in any niche. that we talk about balance only in terms of, are they balanced in combat? Are they balanced in this situation? But instead, we're talking about, do they contribute equally over the long haul of an average generic campaign?
Contribute to what? The success of the party, quote unquote?
The success of the party, the action going on around the table. Do they have
the level of fun? That's kind of unquantifiable.
That's a bear.
Well, that, though, I'd say has more to do with the individual than the character. Yes.
And I think asymmetry yes. can do a lot more for fun than symmetry can.
And we're talking here about balance, specifically.
You know, I think you've got a lot of variables at work here. First of all, it depends on the players. Even with the example of the diplomat as opposed to, a guy in power armor, I think it can come down to the guy who's playing that diplomat. If he's a very accomplished
role
player. And I think you touched on that. Then that's what's going to come from there. And then in that sense, I think you could say that it's balanced. But on the other hand, if it's somebody that's not really good at talking, well, why would they be playing a diplomat in the first place? But
so they can sit back and roll D20 for talk smooth.
And on another thing to think of is your group of players. Do they want to do a combat intensive sort of game? I mean, if that's the case, then it sort of falls back to what you're saying. It's all going to be on combat as opposed to as much role playing. So I what I'm trying to get at is, I think the concept of balance is pretty big. It's kind of difficult to quantify.
Pat, I think a lot of rule systems, though, go at it from the angle that they kind of take the player out of the equation, because, in judging by your example, okay, if you're not a very good talker, don't be a diplomat. They still, a lot of game systems incorporate rule systems to gauge NPC interactions and reactions, and if you get this success, if you get this amount of success, and the NPC reaction switches from antagonistic to bedfellow, that kind of thing, and so it gives you a flow chart to follow along there with that kind of stuff. And so I think that when designers go at it, I think a lot of games try and take the player out of the equation. I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing, because those types of charts, I've never used them. I think it's just kind of wasted pages.
If you're designing a rule system for balance, you kind of have to do that, because the player is the one quantity you don't know. I can give three people the exact same character, and the fact is, if one of them is intelligent, charismatic, and resourceful, and the other two are morons, they're not going to be equal. But that's nothing that a game designer or a game master or anyone else can really control. That's just kind of how it plays out. And so that's why I want to remove the player from the discussion of balance, simply because you can't balance that. I mean, unless you start handing out handicaps based on everybody's IQ.
Like the actual player's IQ.
IQ, the player's IQ. Well, that Chad's too smart.
Or you up the dumb guy's character, or the new guy's character, or the guy who never talks, the Pat. And lots of GMs will do this.
Let's start with that question there. There's one that Pat and Chris kind of hedged into there, which is, does balance even matter? Is balance even necessary to a role-playing game? Chad, you presented in the last episode your view that you don't think it is, or you felt torn on it at least.
Well, I was very torn on it, because I think that ultimately it really shouldn't matter. If Pat and I are playing a role-playing game with you guys, and I have this concept, and I roll up this character that I want, and he can't really contribute to the combat. He's not a killing, healing, or buffing machine. And he doesn't really contribute to like the softer non-combat skill checks, like the bluff or diplomacy or the interaction skills. But it's a concept that I want to role play that's fun, that doesn't detract from anyone else's fun and that sort of thing. Because assuming we're not playing a tactical D&D dungeon crawl, because that would detract from that. And Pat's playing something that's really powerful. That's super, like, we keep using the diplomat or the warrior. I mean, there's many iterations, but Pat's playing a warrior, super powerful warrior, and the mechanics allow that. Like, it comes out like that mechanically. I don't care. I don't care that Pat is more powerful than me. I don't care that he has more equipment and more stuff and more dice, because that's what Pat wants to play. And I want to play this other thing. And if I wanted to play something as powerful as Pat's character, I would just play Pat's character. You know, I would change the fluff around it, but for all intents and purposes.
But the balance for that, though, comes in when, what if play starts to predominate towards one character or the other? What if it goes more towards the talking and the fluffing and the negotiation, and Pat's character suddenly is now, he's you know.
Well, here's what I'm torn about, though. Here's the other side of what I was saying. I don't think the game mechanics, when you buy that book off the shelf, I think that the game should come balanced. I think that all this other extreme stuff that people want to do, like John and I's extreme, we really don't care about how powerful we are, or extreme, our characters have panic buttons built in that are going to kill them, or Pat wants to play a super powerful warrior.
Yeah, that's happened to me before.
Yeah, he wants to play Superman and stuff. I think that the game mechanics should be balanced out of the box, and then it's up to the players and GM to alter the game and unbalance it as much as they want to get the maximum amount of fun out of it.
And I mean, you can balance the skills and the classes or whatever and set yourself at relative power levels.
Yeah.
There's no way a game should be balanced a level 20 character against a level 1 character. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, because when you start getting into it, like you get into a game like Rifts, then the balance pendulum is so far out of whack that the players and the game master really have to put an extra layer of effort on there to make it workable.
See, and I think that's where you can run into some problems. And I think maybe, and I'm going to dip into Kevin Symbiota's brain here for a second. I wonder if that game wasn't put out with the presumption that the players will figure that out. Having read the GM section of the referee section of that game, I don't know if it was properly explained, saying, hey, if you're going to make dude with sword and put him with a glitter boy, you may not necessarily want to do that simply because of the fact that it's going to be a completely game that's just game that's just completely out of whack. If you don't lay some restraints on this, you're going to have problems with your games. If he didn't say that, then I don't know if that... I think then the designers at that point failed in their responsibility to educate the new people who bought that book, having no idea what they were getting into.
Yeah, because with Rifts, it's such an extreme of unbalanced that you can have a guy playing something that's super powered in there as a starting level character, and then you can have somebody play something that's exceedingly weak and unskilled from a combat mechanics standpoint, and even from the diplomacy standpoint, like we keep beating to death, that if they have an encounter, if there's a fight that happens, which there's going to be a lot of fights because it's Rifts and it's generally a combat game, the thing that can challenge and take on the superpower character is going to wipe out the non-powerful character just as collateral damage, not even aiming at it. That's how out of sight that game can be as far as balance issues go. And I think that that's a fundamental flaw with it. Now, I think that it's a really cool role-playing game concept to make a character, to have two people in a party. One is the glitter boy, really, really powerful, and one is the unskilled vagabond who's a bum, who has a really interesting character.
Put yourself for a minute
in a glitter boy powered armor. I hate Rifts, but I would absolutely love to do that.
Well,
when I played Rifts, I did have a glitter boy.
I had a glitter boy as well.
For a minute, put yourself in the shoes of a game developer. And let's walk through basically where the problem of balance begins. Let's say we start off with two different types of characters. And let's just say this game has classes or archetypes or something like that. Okay, just for sake of argument. Character number one has 10 hit points, and in a round will deal 1 point of damage. Character number two has 5 hit points, so half the hit points, but deals 2 damage per round. So what you have right here is you have a tank and a DPSer, okay? Mm-hmm. And both of these characters are balanced. If they have a fight, that fight will last 5 rounds, and really it will come down to who swings first, presuming you don't have misses and such. Very easy to balance that out. But now let's say we're going to throw in a third class. And the third class, we've decided from design standpoints, unlike these two classes, it might be able to do his damage at range. Or maybe it has a secondary effect, like it snares the enemies. Or he can go invisible. What HP and damage ought he do? Because see, the problem is, and I described this in the last show, and I've in prior shows, it's trying to quantify qualities.
Yeah. Well, this is the basic divide between fight guy, skill guy, and maybe sometimes magic guy.
Right.
This has been with us since forever.
Yeah, exactly. And so in this example, you know, like I said, if we've got a warrior and a thief or whatever you want to call these two guys, and all of a sudden I introduce a wizard who has the ability to cast one spell, which is turn invisible, what hit points and damage ought he have? I don't think there's a good answer. And this is where the problem of balance, I think, gets really, really, really ugly, is even without introducing that unknown, that vast unknown of the player, how resourceful, how intellectuals, the player, how many loopholes are there in the rules. Yeah, before we even get to that, we as a game designer have to decide, well, turning invisible is worth 1 point of damage, so this guy's going to have 5 hit points and only deal 1 damage instead of 2.
I believe or something to in that the effect. Ultima Online way of doing it, there are 3 stats, each can be 100, and you have 225 points. Go. You can switch them pretty easily anytime you want. You want to have a big mana pool? All right. Do you want to have no hit points or swing slow? Pick one. What's the old axis with women? Attractive, sane, single, pick 2. That's basically what it is with strength, dexterity, and intelligence. There's no right one to leave out in either.
I've always heard a much less inflammatory one of in business. You have fast, right, and cheap, pick 2.
Yeah, well, that's true, too.
But it's the same kind of thing. Yeah, and Ultima presents a solution to this problem that games like D&D and Rifts don't, which is the fact that your characters effectively can go in any direction. That at no point are you making a choice that specifically negates another series of choices. You can choose to be a guy who wields a sword and casts lightning.
Yes.
Wielding the sword does not preclude lightning. Throwing lightning does not preclude the sword.
But you have a finite number of skills.
There's a finite number of choices you can make. Yeah. But you can mix and match those to the point that you can feel a little bit more balanced. So the problem could come up if some of those skills are more useful than others. And now all of a sudden...
And they almost invariably will be.
Yeah.
And no one is going to take hurting on their PK.
That's one of the problems that I have always
heard. He loves the sheep.
Hell yeah.
Pet takes nipple clamps as a feat.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the problems I've always had with point buy systems, is too many times people end up making the exact same character.
Yeah. Because there's certainly going to be a finite number of templates that are the best, and one could argue that, oh, well, you've just created your classes. But even within those templates, as long as you have the versatility to mix and match, especially as the system changes, Chad talks about Warcraft all the time, they don't have game balance. They just move one up and another one down every couple of months, and that's how they keep the classes in.
It's a conspiracy!
Well, that's how they do it. I mean, there's no BSing around it. I prefer a fluid skill-based system to any sort of class-based system. I can't imagine a fluid class-based system. Class-based system where you can just change your class and keep your relative power level.
I think I made this example in the last episode, or I've made it before on the show, but I was reading an article where they were interviewing a developer for a MMO, and he wasn't telling what MMO he was working on because it was all NDA and that sort of thing. But they were talking about concepts of making an MMO and how that relates, not how it relates to role, but I was kind of applying it to role-playing games. Everyone screams about balance. Everything has to be balanced. You have to be balanced all the time. And he said that in a game where you have multiple classes and all these different kind of abilities, there's really only one way to achieve balance. Every single player has 2 hit points, 1 attack, and it does 1 point of damage.
And the trees were all made equal by hatchet, axe, and saw.
Yep. And that's the only way to do it. And you keep adding, the general role-playing game community, you keep adding these different levels to it. You add, character classes and character abilities. Hell, when you add the variable of melee and ranged, that's an unbalanced thing right there. I mean, how do you balance that? Do you
make longbows do 1d8 and two-handed bastard swords do 1d12.
There you go. But...
And you give attacks of opportunity at melee, and that's just evolved.
You start layering it. And
there's no way you can have perfect statistical parity when you're doing this.
Yeah.
To make it interesting is to make it unequal.
Yeah, that's why it's interesting.
Well, yeah.
And herein comes the very, excuse the pun, but the double-edged sword of the game master. Because on the one hand, John, you mentioned earlier the possibility that if you're playing a game that's about nothing but sneaking through castles with locked doors, then basically the rogue is going to shine and everyone else.
The land
of
the blind, the one at.
Yeah, and everyone else is going to be like, why did I roll up a fighter or a wizard or whatever?
See, that always gets to me when people say that, because it's like, who cares if this person
Because
rolling all these dice all the time and achieving.
Because the topic's balanced, not fun.
And because a lot of people.
That is fun
don't
to
like to sit there on their hands. And I mean,
precisely that.
I don't. I've gone.
Yeah.
Week after week after week, pulling my d- at the table, doing nothing but talking and role playing. You can develop a character that way, but why would you have a system? Why participate in an RPG?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it really gets down to...
Pat, that's not a system, that's a vice.
Oh, okay.
I think it really gets down to how much of your game, what percentage of the game are you pulling from the rules, and how much of it are you pulling from the role play?
Everybody has a different perspective.
But
Dan, you were making a point.
Well, my point is, I mean, I've gamed with a lot of people. Just respond to you real quick. I've gamed with a lot of people where their feeling of usefulness figures heavily into their fun.
Yeah.
That, you know, acting the jester or whatever, have an interesting character should carry them to some point. But if they at no point meaningfully contribute to the events that are going on, they start to really, it detracts from the fun for them. All right, go ahead. Just a quick tangent on this.
Okay.
And then I'll get back to my point, but go on.
Yeah. How do you feel about that detracts from their fun? Well, let's say it's not detracting from their fun. Let's say they're not contributing to the group in a mechanical way.
Okay.
They're contributing in a role-playing way, and I don't even mean the diplomat bluff check and all that sort of thing. They're just role-playing.
Yeah, they're just...
Well, happy for them. Yeah. We have a GM and these players, and everyone's cool, and we can play that.
Yeah,
way.
They're happy with that. Do you think that that negatively impacts other people's fun?
I severely doubt it.
Unless that guy, like, we desperately need somebody who's capable of translating this particular language, and this guy decided to be a douche and intentionally not take that for some reason. Yeah. But we have talked about the self-saboteur
bleeding into the party saboteur and how often that's not very appreciated.
See, I don't know, because I think there are a lot of people out there who, especially when you get into stuff like D&D.
I don't think so overall. I think you'd have to come up with a really weird example.
The best I can get is Bob, who thinks his girlfriend Sally is getting shunted out, and he's pissed off about that, but how often?
And I'm not talking about sabotage either. I'm not talking about you take so many flaws, and all your flaws are you're the target of ninjas, and everyone around you is the target of ninjas, so every game you have three ninja encounters that shouldn't be there.
Well, we should have three ninjas every game. Yeah. It's a fine movie.
You know, how do you know that you don't?
Because it's on VHS in my cabinet where it's sat undisturbed for 15 years.
Could be a ninja right there. You'd never know it.
If you have a character who's not rolling dice at the table and you're having fun, and I know you're having fun, and for some reason that bothers me, that's unhealthy codependence.
Well, yeah.
I mean, that's...
I think you'd have to come up
with a pretty extreme example before I'd say you've got a problem on your hands.
You're either massively jealous or you hate someone at your gaming table, which, while common, is negative.
All right. But here's the double-edged sword of the game master. Because of the fact...
Why can't be a Balax?
You cannot, in my mind, ever perfectly... quantify the quality, okay? You cannot perfectly put a D6 value to turning invisible. The game master, however, can do a lot to help perpetuate that sense of balance by the situations he introduces.
Yes.
For example, if you have the guy in powered armor with twin miniguns and the diplomat, then put in plenty of situations that require twin miniguns, and put in plenty of situations that require diplomacy.
But we're playing D&D.
D20 modern.
But, you know, the point is that if we are sneaking through the castle where all we're doing is sneaking and picking locks, then the game master can just say, you know what? Guess what? We got to the top of the castle, and now there's somebody that...
Yeah.
We need somebody else to defeat. So the game master is going to be aware of the situation, the players, the plot, the context, all the kinds of things that the game developer does not have the advantage of knowing, because a game developer is writing a system for use by any person playing any campaign.
Right.
They're not writing a game system for your
group. A game should be tools in a toolbox.
Yes, absolutely.
So ultimately, what I'm hearing from you is that whether a game is game balanced or not, it ultimately boils down to players getting put in the spotlight too much or not enough, and that is up to the game master whether the game is balanced or not.
Right. And if I was running a Rifts game and one of you's in a Glitter Boy armor and one of you's playing the historian, then I would see to it there was a real need for a thinking man throughout the game. There are going to be problems.
And this is a two-way street. We are always assuming that the power armor guy has the upper hand here, In one of Dan's games, it very well could be the power armor guy sitting on his ass complaining that he never gets
exactly
his time to
how,
shine.
I
but you make a bunch of small corridors available, and suddenly he
say that.
Yeah, he can't do it. He's got to get out of his armor and feel horribly naked and weak, and then, yeah, walk through the small tunnels where the smart guy knows where all the traps are.
That's totally what Dan would do. In fact, I even think I've seen him do that. Some guy's in big, huge power armor or whatever, and you have to go talk to the king in his court, but the doorway is just big enough.
Well, I didn't mean he was being a dick to his players and robbing them of their signature powers. I just meant that there is such a thing as going too far on the pendulum of making knowledge shipmaking the beginning and end of a character sheet. And some people do it.
You're right. You're absolutely right. It was, I tell you, a great study in this, and I wish I had detailed write-ups that I don't, was watching the Danvers game unfold at FearTheCon 1. Two different groups had two radically different approaches to it, and which characters were more useful and less useful changed so radically from one group to the next. And it was really a fascinating case study in this exact issue of balance. And one of them ended up taking a much more combat-oriented solution than the other. In one group, it was the guys with the guns and armor that really managed to pull them through in the end. In the other game, it was the guy that was hacking computers that managed to pull them through. Now, the one thing I would warn about, though, is what the game master has to be cognizant of is their own subconscious biases and their own little quirks. Because, John, as you mentioned, you can swing the pendulum to the opposite extreme where you're so worried about the combat guy dominating the game that suddenly the combat guy becomes useless.
Yeah.
And only the guy that has knowledge shipmaking can do anything.
Or the game itself is a show-off vehicle for your awesome setting, and if someone took knowledge history, they get a two-hour lecture every game, and everyone else sits there.
I've also seen how a game master can do what we're saying here, giving the spotlight to everybody and not giving it to whatever, and they do it wrong. Because I think I've given this example before. I was in one of these games, sci-fi games. Some dude was in powered armor, and he was total combat guy. And this guy was a twink. I mean, he loved playing combat-oriented, min-maxed characters. And he loved fighting, which is fine.
Phil's car comes to mind.
Yeah.
Power armor on wheels.
Yeah. And I was playing a brain guy. I was playing, actually, a time-traveling scientist. And it was the big climax of the thing. There's a big bad on a spaceship, and we were on the bridge of the spaceship, whatever, and the ship was hurtling towards the sun. So I don't even know. It wasn't even that, but there was some critical thing where we had to operate the spaceship, but that guy was there. We could talk about it or whatever. So we get off the elevator, step onto the bridge, nobody even says anything, and the combat guy starts rolling dice. He launches all these missiles in a big swarm at the captain of the ship, who's the bad guy. Well, the missiles hit him and blow up and turn him into paste and logically hit the controls and blow up the controls and destroy the bridge. And, you know, guards are coming and combat guy is fighting and stuff. And I'm just there. I'm a scientist, but I don't have tools. I'm not an engineer. I mean, the bridge is destroyed. It's destroyed. And the game master turns around to me and says, okay. Like, this is your time to shine, woman. Fix the bridge. And I'm like, are you effing kidding me? I mean, it's
I don't
like,
know who this game master was, except I could say it wasn't me, because at no point in my life.
No, it wasn't
was
you.
I
we didn't
this
play this
imagine,
game together.
No. Imagine driving down the highway in a stretch limo at 80 miles an hour, and it's about to go over a cliff, and one of the guys in your party, the chauffeur's the big bad, and he throws a grenade in the front seat. It kills the driver, and then I'm playing a mechanic. We're hurtling down at 80 miles an hour down this highway, and the game master says, looks at me and says, roll your mechanic skill to fix it. No!
You raise another good side point. Blowing everything up should have nasty consequences, aside from the fact that it's generally more immediately dangerous. Deus Ex comes to mind, because I always think about Deus Ex.
Deus Ex is a wonderful game.
Any time you
top
just
five.
Drop the rockets in there, you blow up something you didn't want to, or someone knows about you now or whatever, and I think that's a good element for gaming.
I thought for a minute there you might have been talking about a game I ran, because there was a game I ran where you were playing a time-traveling scientist who was attached to a bunch of heavy combat guys, but the climax was radically different.
Why didn't you travel back in time and fix the bridge? Or tap your guy on the shoulder and be like,
this
hey.
In my game, there was actually a reason, there was an explanation for that.
There was a big pet peeve of mine you have a generic universe, or you have a universe that's not thoroughly defined, or you're adding something to a world or universe that isn't previously defined. And your character agrees to that with the game. You work it out with the game master. I'm playing two different time travelers. One was with you and one was Paul. And you did it. You did it right, but Paul changed the rules on me. I came up with the rules. You know, you have to have rules for time travel. You have to define how paradoxes are. And
what happens if you kill your grandpa?
Yeah, that sort of thing. And I define the rules with him. I define that you cannot create a paradox, because when you go backwards in time and you do something, that's how it always been.
You were there in the original 1945 when you missed Hitler with your rifle.
My thing is like, okay, I'm going to go back in time, and that we have a filing cabinet right here, and I'm going to go back in time 3 weeks. I'm going to put a wrench in the filing cabinet and then travel back forward in time. And then when I open it up, there's going to be a wrench there where there wasn't one before. But before I even go back in time and do anything, I open the cabinet up and I take the wrench out.
Yeah.
Because I have already...
Well, that's how you should do it.
Yeah, and that's kind of like how... And not to start a time travel debate, but that's how I defined it in that.
Yeah.
And then when he was running the game, he threw that all out. It was totally all thrown out. And that just bugged the hell out of me a lot.
In fact, that was kind of a... We could probably do a whole show on time travel, but it was kind of one of the neat things in the campaign, at least that you were playing with me... was the gist of your character was that he came from a point where basically all life was being exterminated. Mm-hmm. And he was in this last cluster of people about to die. And they were like, you have to go back in time and stop this from happening. Your character's like, it's impossible. It can't be done. But they're like, you have to. There is no other way. We have to try.
My character invented time travel. And they came to him as the last hope. And he's like,
yes, it
won't happen. It doesn't work like that. And but he went, they didn't force him, but he went back anyway.
I would.
Because there's no
world blowing up around you.
Yeah.
Hell, I might go back to 1992 if I had my druthers right now.
But it was just for the sake of they had no other options. So they pushed him to do it. And then things happen within the plot that, you know, did make it possible. Yeah. Blah, blah, blah. It's a long story I'm not going to tell. But
you said druthers, John.
I did. I have a lot of druthers.
He also said 1992, which I think was when he was born. But
no.
So there are...
I was a robust 7.
Wow.
So as I was thinking about this...
7 in 1983.
I came up with four things. Whether you are a game developer... or a game master, presuming you're willing to house rule a game, okay, presuming you're not a slave to the book, I came up with four things that I think can help you with game balance throughout the course of your game. The first one is math. It's just the simple fact of, if this guy has twice the hit points, he should do half the damage. If this gun does twice as much damage, it should cost twice as much, whatever. I won't give you the specific math model because it varies from system to system and situation to situation. But the fact is, sitting down, crunching the numbers, and making sure that everything lines up is a good place to start. It's not a good place to end, but it's a good place to start. The second, and this is the only way in which I think you can start to attach numbers to qualities, is experience. You play the game, you see what happens. Holy crap, I didn't realize that this power, and this power together create an atomic bomb. And that's the second thing I'd recommend, is view it through experience, see what happens, particularly if you have different groups of people to try it with, so they all come up with different approaches and different quirks. The third is accept that it's more of an art than a science, and be willing to change situations on the fly. There's a power that's really not all that great, but in this one situation or for this one group, they found a really wonderful way of overusing it. And you've just got to deal with that. You have to find some way of limiting it on the fly. And you're just accepting that some of this is an art. We're going to get you in the right zip code, but we're not going to get you to the right house because it's not possible. Yeah,
and it's really not a sin for your player to realize the two skills work well in tandem and utilize them. I mean, unless it breaks the game, you can't be like, oh, that was effective. I got to break half of one of the skills.
The fourth one, and I'm going to give an example with this, where it's actually me throwing a bone to John, because I don't even agree with the example.
Okay.
But the fourth one, I do agree with the rule, is let the rules conform to the kind of experience you want to create. Okay?
Yes.
Let the rules conform the kind of experience you want to create. The bone I'm throwing to you is maybe the Jedi just plain should be that much more powerful than everyone else.
That was where I was going to go. Oh, you're playing Final Fantasy Tactics. Orlando is absolutely better than everyone. Why? Because he was killing your uncles and your grandpa for the last 50 years. He's been at war since he was in diapers.
And so,
and you're 15 years old.
If part of the experience you want to create is that there's a particular alien race or particular magical academy or I don't know what is just supposed to be out of whack, and that's part of the experience, and that does not detract from the game, because there's a lot of groups that would piss off.
Oh, you may have to keep this strictly to NPCs, and they may bitch about even that.
Yeah.
But odds are someone is going to be stronger or weaker than someone else somewhere in your universe, and that's really okay.
See, you know, something else I've done kind of along those lines, along this rule four, that has been a balancer, is I've put some gambling in character creation. For example, and I use Savage Worlds at Fear the Con 1. The next time I run Danverse, probably not Gen Con, but maybe Fear the Con 3, I'll use the actual rules I've written for it. There's this one race that has a slim chance of having an unexpected psionic ability. And what I do is I put a gamble in there that you have to roll that one attribute a particular way. And if you roll a perfect set of dice, you get the wild psionic power, which actually gives you an edge on everyone and everything else in the game. But if you screw that roll up, you come into the game pretty gimped in that ability. And so there's kind of a...
I've rolled it every time.
Yeah, it's gambling character creation.
Did you ever go to Busch Stadium and see him give two tickets away, or you can go for the doors? I have yet to see him go or take the tickets and sit down. I mean, it's gaming. Come on.
Yeah.
Roll the damn dice.
We're going to go ahead and wrap the show up here. I want to give you guys a preview of something coming next week. We're actually going to record it tonight, but John and Chris both need to split, so we'll record it next week. But next week, I am committing to Fear the Boot Bedtime Stories 3. Chad's got some stories. I've got a story. Everyone else has the homework assignment of coming up with some life anecdotes to tell. So next week, Fear the Boot Bedtime Stories 3. Be prepared for it. I don't know if we'll drop it before or after the regular episode, but it will come out at some point.
So can I do like a more of a Fear the Boot After Dark kind of a thing?
Sure.
Okay, yeah, awesome.
I'll Fear the Boot Up All Night.
Yeah.
There you go.
I'll just mark it explicit. You can tell us about all your escapades with gerbils or whatever it is.
Nice.
Armageddon.
Thank you guys for tuning in.
Armageddon.
You heard that, Chris?
I heard that. Armageddon. Oh my gosh, I never laughed so hard in my life when
Me neither. No, some guy wrote it off, read it off on the radio one time.
Thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next week.
Later.
Later days.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2009. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.